In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, we catch up with writer Jason Aaron. We talk about him writing a Four Bushman story for the Who Won't Wear the Shield one-shot, writing Spider-Man and Wolverine together in Astonishing Spider-Man Wolverine, and the current Wolverine Weapon X storyline. He talks about expanding Wolverine's rogues gallery, not only in the Weapon X series, but the new Wolverine solo series that'll start in September. You'll hear details about the title's debut arc, Wolverine in Hell. Plus, we talk about Jason's current run in the Max Punisher book, and his unique takes on the Kingpin, Bullseye, and the senior citizen version of Frank Castle. Of course, we discuss Scalped, Jason's incredible Vertigo crime series, set with the backdrop of an Indian reservation in Casino. Word Balloon is brought to you by Edward David Gill's technological espionage book, The Expert on Everything, a novel that's been described as Catch-22 meets 3 Days of the Condor. A young man is offered a six-figure job at Vector Systems and is mistakenly handed a prototype piece of technology that can effectively wipe out all privacy in our society. He's pursued by a governor with presidential ambitions, several U.S. senators, and begins to get death threats from the device itself, called Wallace, which seems to have developed artificial intelligence. BookReview.com gives The Expert on Everything 5 stars and calls it a smooth, interesting techno-thriller. You can purchase the book at Amazon.com or at Gill's website, TheExpertOnEverything.com. Check out the book. It's a great read. The Expert on Everything, a novel from Edward David Gill.
So is your son like 4 now?
He's 5. He just turned 5 last month.
Cool. I was listening to our previous two long interviews, and I was listening to the first one, and you had mentioned that your son was 2. So that's why I figured I'd...
Oh, yeah. Well, he's as old as my comic career, basically, because, when he was born, I quit my last day job to stay home with him just because my day job was so shitty that I didn't make enough money that it warranted me to keep working and us to pay child care. So
understood.
I quit that and stayed home with him and started writing comics, full time. Of course, that first year, that full time translated into, probably me making $10,000 or something. So I wasn't exactly rolling in it just yet, but I always think about just that, how that kind of worked out, that it was still good timing and that I've been able to stay home with him, his entire life. Of course, now I'm at the point where I'm busy and it's he's got to go to daycare because I can't get any work done, but it's still been really cool, to be able to work from home and watch a kid grow up all that time, which, most people, you just don't have the luxury of doing.
I've heard Bendis pretty much say the same thing about his kids, and especially, and now your son is at that same age where, now they're little people, and they're certainly more aware,
right.
And you're really enjoying seeing them enjoy things for the first time.
Oh, yeah, my son is a chatterbox. He, I don't know where he gets it from. It's not from my side of the family.
This is true.
He is a talker. And it's cool. He's just now started to get turned on the comics and to he knows a lot of the Marvel characters now through this Superhero Squad cartoon that Marvel does.
Sure.
Which is geared towards kids, which is great because it's got characters like the Falcon and MODOK and Abomination and all these kind of second tier characters. So it's great. I took him to the comic store recently and he's like, "Look, Daddy, there's MODOK and look, those are AIM agents." But that's awesome that he's gotten turned on all that stuff. And he loves the Tiny Titans. I read Tiny Titans to him every night.
That's really cool.
That's his favorite book. He'll just giggle and laugh out loud. And that's a great book, too. I've been reading lots of children's books and children's comic books the last few years, and Tiny Titans is one of my favorites.
They've gotten a lot better. I think, both DC and Marvel's heads have been in the right place, and I think, and hearts, and they've wanted to try and make good product for kids. But I really think, like you just said, I really think Tiny Titans and Superhero Squad as a television show and a comic, I think, is doing a good job. And really, even the Marvel Adventure comics now, and I don't think they're called Marvel Adventures anymore. I'm trying to remember what the rebranding is, but I've read a few of them, and I've been very impressed with... They're fun action stories that don't talk down to kids. They keep it simple enough, and It's true to character, though, and I think that's really important.
Right. Yeah, and I'm sure whoever's tuning in to listen to this podcast didn't expect us to be talking about kids' books. we can segue this back in, and that you know, since I do have a 5-year-old, I haven't written anything, obviously, that he can read for a long time. Most of my stuff is way down the road. So I've been anxious to do some kid stuff. I've been thinking about it for a long time, and I've actually, I don't think this has officially been announced, but I guess we can mention that I've talked to Oni about doing something in their Yo Gabba Gabba anthology that they're working on. So hopefully that'll work out. Because I told James Lucas Jones from Oni had told me, you know, back when they were first started working to get that license, and I told him, like, from the get-go, look, you know, if you ever get this, like, keep me in mind, because I swear to God, no other writer in comics is going to be more qualified than me to write this, because I've seen every episode of the show, because my son loves it. But so they, you know, the Yo Gabba Gabba people, if they've heard of my work, I'm probably not the first guy they're going to think of to write something for this, but, like, for real, just keep me in mind. So, you know, hopefully that'll work out if I get to do that. And then, you know, to actually have something I can read to him at bedtime would be great.
Well, if you want to clinch the deal, make sure you send him the scene from Punisher Max where the guy pops his eyes back in his head. And
right, yeah. I just hope they haven't seen all that stuff.
You know, so Jason, now I tease you all the time for you know, being you know, Joe Intimidation, because that's just, you know, you would in neutral, you know, I've made enough jokes about it. But the great thing is, you're a funny guy, and it showed in the you know, Who Won't Wear the Shield issue that came out with your rapper on, and that's why I'm fully confident. We'll talk about that in a second, but I'm fully confident seeing all the facets of Jason Aaron in person and in his stories, that I think you can write a very capable children's book. So I you know, that's excellent.
I appreciate your confidence. But yeah, even that, the Who Won't Wield the Shield was still, you know, it was really me poking fun at myself and that kind of the stories that I write, I guess. Still obviously not appropriate. I get shot in the face in that one, so I can't read that one to my kid.
That's true. All of you guys end up with grisly deaths at the end of that story.
Right. Well, I figured I was going to make fun of Ed and Matt and all those guys. I needed to, you know, make fun of myself and get myself out of the way first. So hopefully I did a good enough job of that before I moved on to the rest of those guys.
I have to say, the wraparound was the best part of that issue. I thought it was great.
Oh, thanks. That was a blast. I know Matt said about his story that he figured that was as close as he would ever come to writing for Mad Magazine, and I kind of felt the same way. It was that was a lot of fun, you know, because I loved those old, like Mott Brandeck and what the Marvel did.
So. Sure.
So as soon as Stephen Wacker offered me that gig, and he told me it was kind of up in the air as to what I could do, and he showed me the cover that had Forbush Man on it, and I said, well, you know, for sure I want to do a Forbush Man story, which he was kind of surprised by, I guess, but, I mean, the chance to do Forbush Man, I was all over that. You know, and, you know, I don't want to ever be pigeonholed as just the guy who does books about people who shoot each other or stab each other with claws. I mean, I do like that kind of stuff, but, you know, hopefully I've got more in me than just that. You know, I should be obvious from the stuff I've done so far that I love writing Spider-Man.
Yes.
It's hard writing. It's hard. It doesn't come easy for me to write Spider-Man, but I love doing it, and I'm proud of the stuff I've done writing Spider-Man so far. I think, you know, one of the about the most fun I've ever had writing any page of any script was the one from I think the last issue of Weapon X that came out. That was just a page of mostly a page of Spider-Man and Thing mm-hmm. going back and forth with
yes.
Spider-Man. Doing all of the Thing's catchphrases, I had a blast writing that page. I was laughing out loud writing that page. So hopefully I am a little more than just the dude you come to if you want, you know, brains on the wall and people get raped and shot in the face and that sort of stuff.
Well, let's stick on that story arc right now, because in a lot of ways, I think this current Wolverine Weapon X story is the most mainstream thing you've written. And I know you got the first chapter, too, of your Spider-Man Wolverine miniseries, the Astonishing Spider-Man and Wolverine. Mm-hmm. Is that the correct order, or is it Astonishing Wolverine and Spider-Man?
Astonishing Spider-Man Wolverine.
Thank you. Okay. I really...
Astonishing Wolverine Spider-Man is a different book. Somebody else says that one.
Oh, there you... Well, the... This particular arc in Weapon X is great on so many levels. The Deathlocks as Terminators, I think, is a blast. Bucky is John Connor. If Bucky is the general, I guess we don't know yet, technically.
No, you don't know who the general is yet.
Sure. So, and am I right to assume that it's going to be explained in the story how Wolverine with his healing powers is suddenly, you know, without his hands?
No, that's never explained.
Okay. That's fine.
Well, that was, in some way, a little tip of the hat to the, wasn't the Age of Apocalypse where Wolverine was missing one of his hands?
Oh, that's true. Yeah, you know.
His claw came up in nubs. So I just took it a step further, and then in this timeline, he's missing both of his hands. But no, I never wanted to explain that. And then, you don't really know anything that's happened to that character in the time between the present and how he's ended up where he's at.
Well, that's fine. And, again, this is my X-Men blind spot, because while I'm aware of Age of Apocalypse, it wouldn't come to immediate recall. So that's a fair point. I can see that. No, and again, I'm not even saying to call you on it. I wonder, I'm like, oh, is this going to be explained or not? But again, as you say, it's happened before. So that's cool.
Really, but that whole issue, the issue where we see that future Wolverine, the main thing I wanted to do with that is just show that, this is not another Wolverine in the future storyline. That's not the point of this. That I introduced that future Wolverine and then we kill him off by the end of that issue.
Yes.
Just to show that, I'm not trying to do my version of Old Man Logan or Days of Future Past or any of that. I mean, you do nods to some of that stuff across the storyline, but I just wanted to show that that's not the focus of it. That it's that stuff in the future is important, but important for a different reason.
Well, and it's interesting to see that even without his hands, Logan is still dangerous, and that was great to see. And it was funny how the woman that goes back to the past is the present, I should say. Yeah, she's not. She figured Logan to be useless, but he came through.
All right, well, when you've got a metal skull, you can headbutt the shit out of somebody. Nothing else. One of my favorite things from that future bit is that Logan has no hands and he's got like a hook hand on one of them.
Right.
And Ron Garney, as a joke, added all these little pouches on his costume. So he's got all these tiny little pouches along his belt, which was all Ron. I saw that and thought, that was genius.
He used to be very dainty with his hooks to reach those pouches.
I guess so, yeah. He's an expert with that hook.
You must have pincers or something at the end of the hook or something, yeah. That's very cool. No, it's and also expanding on not only Logan's relationship with Steve, but Logan's relationship with Bucky as well, and that's very interesting to see. And it's great having Bucky back to stay, and have him play in the Marvel Universe. And this is a great opportunity, I think, for you to play with Bucky, obviously.
Oh yeah, I agree. The first Marvel summit I went to is the one where one of the big topics of discussion was, all right, Steve's coming back, and what's going to happen? Is Steve going to put the costume back on, or is Bucky going to stick around? And I was one of the guys on that side of wanting Bucky to stick around, because I love what Ed has done with that character, and it seemed a shame to just sort of to shuffle him off to the side that quickly. So I'm glad that he stuck around, and this Deathlock storyline was twofold. It was one, I really wanted to do a Deathlok story and introduce a new version of Deathlok that was more throwback to the original Luther Manning version.
Yep.
And then I really wanted to do a story with Cap and Bucky, so it worked out to where I got to do Steve and Bucky. So that was great. And that first issue, just writing Logan and Steve going out for beers, was a blast. And then just having those two guys together talking was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, and it's because we've only seen a handful of stories of them back in the War Years. So, and I don't think we've seen much of them playing with each other in present day, where they are, you know, on that kind of friendly terms. And it was neat. Or you know what I mean? It's just cool seeing them now.
Yeah, I mean they were in the Avengers together for a while, but you didn't get a whole lot of one-on-one interaction. And I think I think Steve was the one who kind of voiced opposition to Tony wanting to invite Logan into the Avengers in the first place. So
yep.
I liked writing the scene where Steve had kind of come around and, actually thanked Logan for being there. And there's a lot to work with those two guys. If nothing else, just the fact that they're both so much older than everybody else around them.
Yeah, they're in that unique kind of clique of the two of them in Fury. Really, no one else has seen the world like they have.
Right. That was a blast. And then, there's a lot to work with Logan and Bucky, too, obviously, with the stuff like the Daniel Way is set up with...
Yes.
Bucky killing Logan's former love interest and Dawkins' father and all that stuff. So, yeah, getting to play with all that and then throw in a new Deathlok in and... then I figured, what the hell? Let's throw some more Avengers in there. So I got the right thing and Luke Cage and Spider-Man. And, that story has been a lot of fun.
Was there what was the editorial edict on Wolverine Weapon X? I mean, or was it your free reign to say, hey, this is what I want Weapon X to be?
Well, they came to me, with the movie coming out, and they wanted to do a new Wolverine book, and give me my shot. I'd done kind of Wolverine stories here and there.
Great Wolverine stories here and there. We've talked about them before. Absolutely.
Thanks. So there was no edict beyond that, and the first arc, they'd like it to be something that kind of somehow tied into the whatever they were doing in the movie. And, I didn't read the script or anything. So I didn't really know other than any more than anybody else did. But
did they give you broad strokes of what the movie was going to be about, or?
Not really. No. I mean, I just knew, what everybody else had read in the news, and but beyond that, I didn't know. But I just said from the beginning that I wanted to do kind of the same sort of structure as what Garth had done on Punisher Max, and that I wanted to do standalone arcs that. With new villains. I didn't want to use the same stock Wolverine villains because, Wolverine's got some good villains, but most of them involve a lot of explication and that they have these long histories with him that are complicated. They've known him for, 75 years, and I wanted to do new characters that they don't have to explain anything. It's new reader-friendly, but something that still had an overarching story, but there was some character development over the course of that. So that was the idea. I mean, from the get-go, I think that's, for the most part, what we did. I don't really know if those are the kind of stories that people want from a Wolverine book. So I'm very happy with what we've done on Weapon X. I don't know if the book was a success or not. I mean, in terms of sales, I don't know if it sold what Marvel wanted. I think the title itself was kind of confusing in that people saw it and thought that this was a book that was just about Logan's Weapon X days. It was a... So the $3.99 book, one of the first $3.99 books, which a lot of people are still sore about. So, I enjoyed writing the book. I don't know if it was exactly the kind of Wolverine book people want. I think with the new book, the new Wolverine series, if nothing else, it'll still be similar in terms of setup, and then I want to use new characters. I want to change it up for Mark Dark, but I think it'll be a little bit bigger, and we will see more of characters from Wolverine's past popping up. Hopefully still used in ways that are always accessible to new readers.
Well, I hope people reach back if they haven't to read some of these arcs, because I think they've been great. And, you know, so it's I'm glad that, you know, Marvel, you know, still wants you writing Wolverine, because I think it's a good match. And you're right. Maybe it was the title or something like that. I wasn't sure where the sales were, and understood that, you know, yeah, they were coming back with a number one. But, you know, that happens so much in publishing that I almost, you know, glaze over it, especially given that they're sticking with a good, you know, creator, much like Jeff Johns. I mean, Jeff Johns had a great run on JSA. They take a break and they come back with Justice Society number one, and it's like, well, it's still Jeff Johns. You know, I mean, that's great. I mean, but again, if it means, and obviously when you get to another number one, it usually means that there's going to be a spike in sales. It'll give people a chance to jump on. And I always come to Wolverine with fresh eyes. I am one of those readers that hasn't really invested in decades of Wolverine reading. I've read a lot of the better stories. For me, it's always who's writing Wolverine first. That's what interests me in going to it. And that's why I've enjoyed Dan's series, and I've enjoyed what you're doing as well. And I like the fact that you're using Deathlok the way you are. And I wonder, much like Matt taking, and really just, you know, the Marvel Universe taking Norman Osborn, everybody, and suddenly Norman is much more of a threat to a lot of other heroes than he was once before. Without naming names, because I don't want you to spoil any stories, but are there existing Marvel villains that really don't have a big history with Wolverine that you're like, oh, these two are meant to, you know, face each other?
That's a good question, yeah. Yeah, there are some that I've got a short list. Now, whether we'll see those in Wolverine or, you know, if I get to do more Spider-Man Wolverine, one or the other. But, yeah, I've got at least one big Marvel U villain that, as far as I know, has never faced Wolverine that, you know, once I sat down and thought about it, seemed like a no-brainer. So I don't want to say who it is, but, yeah, that's a direction I've wanted to go, because, you know, I think Wolverine could use his rogues gallery beefed up a little bit. Like I said, there are a lot of villains who have this long, complicated history with them, and it's hard to kind of boil down, like, you know, what is really this person's deal and what is this person's beef with him beyond some, you know, sordid history that's hard to explain. So, yeah, I do want to beef that up a little bit. You know, and I look at Wolverine as kind of like Punisher, and that he's one of those characters that I think works great if you're kind of boiling down to, you know, the sort of the bare essence, and then just throw him in lots of different crazy situations and really focus on all the crazy shit you can swirl around him. You know, that's what I loved about Garth's Punisher Max run. And that's kind of what I've always been trying to do with Wolverine. And if you look at all the Wolverine stuff I've done over the last few years, it's kind of all over the map in terms of the genre. And yeah, I want to keep that up. So with the new Wolverine book, really the first year, almost the first year, will be one big storyline. This Wolverine Goes to Hell storyline is a big one over the course of a couple arcs. As we see Logan sent to hell and figuring out what's going on, and you know, his body is running around on Earth possessed by demons. And we have no idea who's responsible for this, and that ultimately turns out to be a set of entirely new villains. So that'll be one big storyline, but beyond that, we'll see completely different kinds of stories. You know, I've got a big sci-fi sort of story that I want to do.
Interesting.
With Logan. And, you know, I'd love to come back and follow up and do another straight, crazy kung fu story with Wolverine. So, you know, it'll continue to mix it up from arc to arc.
That's great, man. And I can only imagine that we'll see some familiar faces down in hell, as Wolverine is now.
Yeah, I mean, you gotta think. You know, Logan's been around for what, over 100 years now and has been killing people from an early age. So at this point, you know, hell's going to be pretty choked full of people that he sent there. So you got to imagine there's going to be a lot of folks. You know, there's got to be, just in terms of ninjas, there's got to be, you know, thousands of ninjas there waiting for him, and ninjas. So yeah, there's going to be a lot of folks there waiting to get a piece of Logan. Some of them, you know, will be very familiar faces. There will also be a few friendly faces there. Now, he's had a few, you know, people on his good side who are going to wind up there. So yeah, lots of familiar faces popping up.
That's great, man. It sounds like you're stretching the character the way Remender stretching the Punisher in his Punisher series with Frankencastle.
Right. Yeah. This is. I'm trying to use some of the sort of the stuff I used in Ghost Rider to bring a little bit of that flavor.
Absolutely.
The Wolverine, and that, you know, it really like one of the main things I set out to do with the story, and that Renato Wiedis has drawn it. Totally bought into and sold, is that I really wanted to do I wanted to define hell and give a real sense of place to hell, which we don't usually see. Usually hell is portrayed as just sort of a smoky cave with a few fires burning here and there and some demons running around. You know, the most of this first storyline is set in hell, and it's really about hell being this you know, ridiculously overcrowded prison. It's you know, if you think of like the Stephen Grant Mike Zeck Punisher miniseries where he goes into prison, or you know, the scenes in Watchmen with Rorschach going to prison. This is the same sort of storyline, but on an exponentially bigger scale, and that hell is crammed with untold number of souls crammed into this place. The biggest, most overcrowded prison you can imagine. So how do you portray that? And so that was a big part of the book, is defining that and giving it a real sense of place. And I had a lot of ideas, and Renato has ran with them, and some jaw-dropping stuff in the way that he's drawn hell. And as far as I'm concerned, whatever I write hell for in the Marvel Universe, it'll be this one. I think we've defined it in a real tangible way.
Very interesting.
So that's been a blast. I mean, just writing the devil, and, you know, we'll probably see Son of Satan pop up in
sure.
this line. So using crazy stuff like that and with Wolverine, which I don't think we've seen much of that with Wolverine so far, certainly not in recent years.
That's
all that stuff's been a blast.
Say that again?
I said all of that's been a blast.
That's terrific, man. And,
just in terms of, like, the, you know, the new number one and the remembering... I mean, I think we needed to do this within the Wolverine, you know, family of titles, and that it made sense to do this because, you know, there hadn't been a book titled Wolverine in quite a long time, for over a year now, almost 2 years, I guess. You know, and Dark Wolverine had still been doing great, so it made sense to just realign things, and, you know, everything is clearly defined now. We've got Wolverine, we've got... You know, Dokken has his own book.
Yes.
Marjorie's doing X-23, so we've got a clearly defined a family of Wolverine titles. So, you know, I know people always kind of roll their eyes and moan when they see, oh, here's another number one, but, you know, I never really worry about that stuff. I think the number on the cover is a pretty small part of what... I worry about it. As long as the story's good and the books are exciting, I think that's the most important thing. So I'm really happy with the Wolverine stuff we've got coming up. I think if Wolverine Goes to Hell story will be the the biggest Wolverine thing I've done.
And this starts in September?
Yep.
That's cool. It's like I said, man. I you're a great fit for Wolverine, so I agree with you as far as number ones go. I mean, it doesn't matter as long as the right creative people are writing. I'm a happy person, and drawing for that matter. And Guidis, didn't he just do? He did a lot of action and Superman stuff, right?
Right, yeah, yeah. He had done a lot of DC stuff.
Yeah. So is he...
I don't know if this is his first Marvel gig. It may be.
Well, that's great, because, yeah, I've been reading all the War on, the World of New Krypton stuff, so... No, I think he's a wonderful artist, and I think it's going to be great seeing the two of you guys together, just as much as I've enjoyed Garney doing Weapon X.
Yeah, Ron is great, and, he and I we've done a bit of stuff now together. We did the Get Mystique storyline.
Yes.
And Wolverine, and we've already lined up something to do right after Wolverine 2 that's still a secret, but something that'll be coming out next year that... he and I will be working on, maybe even something beyond that. We've talked about a couple different things, but for sure we've already got one lined up. I'm actually supposed to write the first issue next week.
Well, this is very exciting. I think that's great, and I can't wait to see preview art. I imagine in San Diego we might see some glimpses of what to expect in September.
Maybe so. Yeah, I won't be at San Diego. I'm actually skipping the show this year. But,
oh.
The show's just. It almost killed me last year. I don't know, I got sick and was throwing up and thought I was going to die. And
oh, jeez.
Just exhausted. I mean, I love going to the shows mostly just to meet fans and to hang out with the creators, but the show's just so big, I mean, at this point, I almost prefer going to, like, Heroes and Emerald City in Baltimore and those smaller shows where... you just have, it's just more relaxing. It's just easier to just sit and talk with fans and have drinks and not as crazy.
I understand, man.
The Planet Comic Con we have here in Kansas City is a good smaller regional show, too.
Yeah, that just happened, didn't it, about a month or two ago? Or longer?
Yeah, it was a couple months ago, I think.
Was it March? Maybe it was March. I was thinking it was like April or May.
I forget.
Yeah.
I think it was March. Yeah, and we had a... It was a good show this year.
Very cool. And as
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you go ahead and say about Planet Comic Con. Go ahead.
That's right. I can't ever complain about the show because it's literally 7 minutes from my house.
I understand. That's how I am with the Wizard Chicago show. I literally live 10 minutes away from the convention center, but. Now, you, as we're recording this, you had just gone to Crescent City. What was the name of that? Or Cherry?
Cherry Capital Con, yeah.
Thank you, Cherry Capital Con. That's right, Traverse City.
Traverse City is the cherry capital of the world, apparently.
I had no idea.
Or at least the cherry capital of northern Michigan.
It was a nice show?
It was a really good show. I had some travel problems getting there, but not the fault of the convention. It was the fault of Delta and then... whatever demented madman designed the Minneapolis airport. That place is a sprawling mass of out of order trams and walkways. But yeah, the show was really good. And if nothing else, I got to meet Steve Dillon for the first time.
Oh, fantastic.
In person, got to hang out with him.
Very cool.
That was a blast.
That's wonderful.
He tried to explain cricket to me one night about 3 a.m. over some Guinness. Which only made me even more confused. I've kind of given up on understanding the next sport. I'm still working on soccer. He was trying to increase my appreciation of soccer, which maybe I'll have a better chance with that. But cricket, I'm just fucking writing that off. I have no idea what's going on in that.
Are you watching the World Cup?
I haven't watched much of it yet. I usually... every time it rolls around, I'll sit and try to watch some and try to foster an appreciation, but I haven't gotten there yet.
I mean, I'm with you.
I'm a football, I love football fan. I live and breathe football, and I can sit down and watch a football game, even if it's a low score in like 6-3 defensive battle. I can appreciate it because I love, I appreciate the philosophies of football. I understand the philosophy, so I can understand, like, well, this is a blitzing 3-4 defense against this, West Coast style offense, so I can appreciate that kind of stuff. But soccer, I just don't get it. It's just it's a lot of probing and probing and probing and a kick and miss, and then we start probing again. I haven't got to where I understand the philosophies of really what all these different guys are doing. I just, when you break it down, I mean, a tackle in soccer just will never excite me like seeing a 250-pound middle linebacker, you know, knock the shit out of a fullback. I mean, a soccer tackle is not really a tackle. It's like you sort of slide into somebody. You're like, I want to see them really just fucking mow each other down. So.
Yeah, Ricky Henderson, I think, was more aggressive when he slid into people than what we're seeing in a soccer field. I understand.
Right. I mean, it's something else I appreciate, the rivalries, because, you know,
yes.
I mean, I grew up in Alabama, so Alabama-Auburn is one of the biggest sports rivalries you have in the country. But
indeed.
Obviously, that doesn't compare to historic rivalries. You know, you've got Germany and the Netherlands, you know, pissed off because Germany stole their bicycles after the war. So you've got, like, weird, like, bitter, you know, decades-long historic rivalries that are played out on the soccer field. So that kind of stuff is fascinating. It's just I don't get the game. I've tried.
I agree, though. The fandom is interesting to watch as well. And, you know, even when I worked at Sporting News Radio, the Los Angeles station was one of our hub stations, KCMP, and they were the LA Galaxy, you know, home. And there were bars there's a bar in LA called the Fox and Hound that specializes in English soccer and stuff. And I went there a few times, and it was fun as hell to see. And you know, just it's I would say even more rabid than like you say, football fans and everything. I mean, they they take it seriously.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. You've never watched a game in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, so maybe if I took you down there sometime, you might hear the same thing.
Understood. Understood.
We're pretty serious about our football down south.
I hear you. That's awesome, man. I wanted to. You mentioned that Wolverine is going to be this, you know, very long story to start with, and you know, obviously, we're getting the same feeling in the Punisher Max series. In a very cool way. And again, I asked the same question I asked about Wolverine. Is there an edict? I mean, coming off of Garth's run, because there is this kind of year one feeling about the stories, given, you know, what you're doing with the Kingpin and Bullseye for that matter. So, you know, is this your device, or is this something that you and Axel worked out? Tell me.
There wasn't really an edict. When Axel came to me, well, really, it started with me lobbying for the job. When I first started working with Axel, it was just around the time that they announced that Garth was leaving the book. So I quickly, you know, started throwing my name in there in the mix and said, you know, I would love to be, you know, I would love to get a shot at this when Garth is done. So I was talking to Axel for a long time about getting in the mix, and he eventually came to me and offered me the relaunch. He asked me if I was interested in doing Kingpin, Marvel or Max version of Kingpin. So really, that was the only setup. And from that, I jumped at that idea. I thought that was great. And I said, well, if we're going to do Kingpin, we have to do Bullseye. So he was down with that. But you know, from that, I as soon as I knew we were going to do that, I knew it needed to be a bigger story, and that I, like we talked about, I love the setup Garth had on the Max book, where it was basically a series of sort of loosely connected miniseries, and that you could read any of those stories and get complete, you know, story within those five issues. So I knew I needed to change that up, and this was a bigger enemy that we needed to build up before Frank would ever have a chance of taking him down. So, you know, it's one big storyline over the course of four, maybe five arcs. So that's different. But beyond that, I didn't really know. I didn't go into the book thinking, like, well, I want to do something that's somewhere in the middle between Garth's Max stuff and his Marvel Knight stuff. I think that's just how it kind of came out. I think some people have read my Punisher stuff and been surprised, thinking that I guess I was going to write a book that was more like Scouts, a little more grittier, I guess, just a little more realistic, I suppose. I mean, you know, Punisher can have some pretty over-the-top violence in it, obviously.
I think we've seen that.
Eyeballs popping out and stuff.
Stapling fingers.
But, I mean, this is kind of the only Punisher book I know how to write. I don't know how to do. I couldn't do a scalped with the Punisher in, basically.
Why not?
I don't know why not. I just don't know how to do that. I think part of it is I knew I couldn't come in and try to do the exact same book Garth had done. I can't do those exact same kind of stories. I think that would be horrible. That would be a terrible mistake. I'm not Garth. I can't follow exactly in his footsteps. We had to change it up somehow just to give it a different twist.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. To me, it's like once you put a guy in there with what's basically still a costume. I mean, whether it's a stripped-down version of a superhero costume or not, it's still a guy in a costume. I didn't know how to write that within... I couldn't just put that into the middle of Scalps and carry on with that same kind of story. It just didn't work for me. I think it was a little... I know Garth, I remember years ago talking about trying to write a Sergeant Rock story. He was writing a story set on D-Day, and he just didn't know how to do it, where he's got, Sergeant Rock and all the guys from Easy Company, hitting the beach in Normandy, and it just didn't work for him. I think in the same way with me. I didn't know, I don't know how to do that, to write that kind of story with the Punisher. To me, this is kind of the only Punisher story I know how to do.
But it's still Frank. Go ahead. No, I'm sorry. I don't want to step on you, man. You think a lot. I like that.
That said, I think it's... I don't look at it as a story that's just about, what kind of crazy, over-the-top violence can I do this issue. I think there's still meat on the bones. I was very happy with how that first Kingpin arc wrapped up. I think that, that first issue, that last issue... I thought, that's hopefully got some real punch to it. So, we see crazy shit along the way. The first issue of the Bullseye arc, as I wrote there, I was writing half the issue involved a bowel movement, and I was writing that thinking, they're not going to let me do this. This is crazy. And I said it off to Axel, and he's like, I love it.
Well, I love it too, man, and it's been those kinds of shocking revelations and visuals that I think do make this a very interesting book. And Steve has always been that kind of shocking artist. I mean, we've seen it, as you say, in Garth's run on Marvel Knights, and also even with Dan in the early days of Wolverine, and I'm blanking right now, Wolverine...
Wolverine Origins.
Thank you, Wolverine Origins. So... It works. And also Dave's covers, I think. I mean, that's the thing. This whole thing, it is still gritty Punisher, but yeah, it is hyper realistic. And I think that makes it more interesting. And you guys are all pushing it. And I think it succeeds, because I would, just like you, loved the realism of Garth's run, loved Tim's covers, loved every artist that worked with Garth. From Doug Brathwaite and, Bill Reinhold on. I mean, all of the guys that touched that book are fantastic. But it's, is there a feeling now, and I know, with using Kingpin and Bullseye, you don't want it to be too Marvel Universe, because, Max needs to still be its own thing. But, I mean, is there room for other Marvel villains to have a Max version of these other villains down the road?
Oh, I think so. Hopefully this will help open up some of those doors. And just in terms of this Punisher story, we'll see one other villain pop up before I'm done with Punisher. At least one, probably just one. But beyond that, I may write something else with Bullseye, the Bullseye Max story. I'd love to do that.
Are you only going to be on the Max series for a finite, period of time, less than, the 50 issues we got from Garth?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
This isn't a court of law, but I appreciate the answer and the brevity. I like that a lot. That's very good.
This is all one story. This is one long story that will probably be four arcs, with maybe a little bit more sprinkled in there along the way.
Okay. Okay, so good.
That's not to say I'll never write Punisher again. There are other Punisher stories I'd like to tell. I mean, this is not even the Punisher story I ever envisioned doing in the first place. I had Punisher ideas that I wanted to do when I was first talking to Axel, and then when he suggested Kingpin, that's when all this came about. So there's other Punisher stories percolating that I'd like to do at some point, but in terms, for now, I mean, what I'm committed to is this one big story. After that, I'll probably move on to something else, but I think there are lots of other characters, the heroes and villains in the Marvel Universe that would work great in a Max setting. I don't know if we'll start to see more of that or not. I think Axel's interested in doing some of that.
Yeah, I almost wonder if, and I must have a new conversation with Axel about this, because listening to an older conversation, I remembered again that they really were very careful to keep the Max line its own, thing. And I even remember talking to Bendis about, Jessica Jones and making the shift from the Max series that Alias was to bringing her properly into the Marvel Universe and how some things had to change. By the same token, Axel very adamantly pointing out that if people didn't like Garth Ennis's Nick Fury, to remind them that that's just the Max Universe Nick Fury. That doesn't, it doesn't mean it has to be that, right, a realignment of the 616 Nick Fury to fit. But what I like about this current, go ahead if you want to comment on that.
I was going to say that I think the line was blurry with Garth's Punisher stuff, because if you look, there's a lot of carryover from his Marvel Knights series into his Max. Some of those Yorkie pops up who had popped up in Marvel Knights, and I think there's a social worker at one point returns, so characters cross over. I think that line was blurry, but obviously with the stuff I'm doing now, it's very clearly defined, and this is a completely different universe. This is not the same Wilson Fisk who's fought Daredevil. There is no Daredevil in Frank Castle's world. There's just Frank, and that's it. There are no other superheroes. So it should be very clearly defined now that this is a completely different universe.
Well, and I love, as you say, the journey that Wilson has gone through from this first issue to where we are right now in the middle of the Bullseye story, and we're seeing his rise. I loved Bruce Jones's Kingpin series that didn't make it. I thought that was a really interesting take. Did you read it as well?
I did, yeah. I read that at the time it was coming out. That was Sean Phillips, wasn't it? Did you do that?
I think you're right.
I didn't reread a lot of Kingpin stuff when I was first working on this. It was kind of that thing where I wanted to, I mean, I've read the big stuff, and I didn't really want to go back and reread it all fresh for fear of ripping something directly off. But
sure,
it's good to kind of have that stuff like very deep in the back of your brain. But I did pull out those Kingpin issues and reread some of those. That's good stuff. I like all the stuff that Bruce Jones was doing back then for Marvel.
Vanessa is a very different woman, it seems, in your Max series.
I'm sorry?
I think Vanessa, Kingpin's wife.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, I liked playing with Vanessa and with, Fisk's son.
Richard,
obviously. Yeah, you come into the series with, both of those characters have long histories in the Marvel Universe, so to play with those expectations a little bit with both of those characters was interesting. And Vanessa, if you've read the most recent issue, she pops up again, so you see that there's still more story to tell with her, and that she's still got more to come. There's actually the next issue. I think it's the next issue. One of the later issues in this arc, there's a scene between her and Bullseye where they cross paths that will turn out to be very important for her.
Interesting. And that's the thing. She's not the China doll that she was during the Miller years. She's not the husk of a woman dying that she was during the Brubaker years. This is a very, like I said, yeah, I mean, there's definitely, issues that she's going through. And but she's a stronger woman, at least, at this stage of the story. Slightly stronger.
Sure, yeah. I mean, she was kind of the perfect match for Wilson Fisk initially when we first see them, that they're you know, they're a great couple. But she knows everything that he's doing. She has no qualms with it. She supports him. She loves him. They seem to be soulmates in one sense. And, you know, they both really love their kids. They're both really devoted to their kids. So we obviously, you know, we see Wilson Fisk put in a situation where he's got to choose between everything he's worked his life to get and then the child that he supposedly was working to get for. And he's got to make a decision. And we obviously see, you know, the decision he makes, how that, how he's still coming to grips with that and dealing with that and haunted by that.
And I think you found a new way to make Bullseye crazy. Great people have touched Bullseye and put their own spin on him, but I think this feels fresh to me.
Well, good. I mean, with Bullseye, you know, the challenge was how do you translate him over to the Max universe? And that, you know, I think the Bullseye's calling card is just the way he kills people, that he can use anything as a weapon. So he's killing people with toothpicks and screwdrivers and, you know, whatever might be on hand. So I obviously didn't want to do that in the Max setting. So the idea is, well, you know, how do you make him dangerous and scary? And, you know, just boiling down, he's the assassin who never misses. So once he sets his sights on somebody, he's going to bring him down. And the question was, well, how does he do that? Well, I thought back to one of my favorite movies, is Michael Mann's Manhunter, you know, which is based on The Red Dragon by Thomas Harris.
Yes.
And the Will Graham character in that story I love. And I love William Peterson in general, but I love that movie. I love that character. And, you know, he's the profiler. He's the guy who literally gets inside the head of the, well, not literally, but he gets inside the head of the serial killer and figures him out in ways that nobody else can. And so I wanted to make Bullseye really the Will Graham of assassin. And that no matter who you are, he's going to get inside your head and he'll figure out how to get to you no matter how hard you are to bring down. So when we initially see him in this arc, he seems to just be crazy. His methods are insane and they seem to have no reason, and you figure there's no way in hell any of this could actually work. But as you start to see, it does work, and that there is a method to his madness. And by the end of this arc, we'll see that he does get inside Frank Castle's head like no one ever has. And really, he figures something out about Frank that we haven't seen before, that really goes back to Frank's origin. Something that doesn't make sense when you really sit down and start to think about Frank's timeline and his origin. There's something that doesn't make sense, and Bullseye gets hung up on that and can't figure it out, and eventually something snaps and he does. And so when the end of this arc, when he comes at Frank, or when they have their confrontation, he's able to hit Frank not just in a way that hurts him physically, but really stab him mentally in a way that we haven't seen. And so by the next arc, the third arc of the series is just titled Frank, and it's very much diving into Frank's head as he's left to grapple with what Bullseye hits him with. So we flash back to Frank's origin, to his family life, and see some stuff from that we haven't seen before.
Well, I think you've telegraphed where some of these areas in terms of Bullseye's methods to get to know Frank better. Further, and again, in a much different way than what Garth and Derek Robinson did in their miniseries Born, we're learning a lot about Frank in Vietnam in some ways that I don't know have been explored before when we're hearing Frank and his former troop buddy, the doctor that he's going to in this
right.
series to patch him up, kind of, you know, speak the truth about, you know, the person that Frank was and the person that Frank is now.
Right. Yeah, another big part of that is I wanted to address Frank's age.
Yes.
I think that has to be addressed. And, you know, I that's what I love about the Max book, is that he is still a Vietnam vet, that he aged in real time. You know, you read Garth's Max run, and it moves along in real time. So
he's essentially 60. Probably.
Yeah, I mean, he has to be. At his youngest, he's got to be in his early 60s. So, you know, at some point that has to be addressed. And I like the idea of you know, not only am I building up this huge villain for Frank to face, this huge challenge, but over the course of that, his body starts to betray him, and that, you know, he may be in great shape for his age, but he's also been through hell along the way. He's been shot and stabbed and blown up and God knows what, you know, so many times over the last 30 years that that's just got to start to catch up on him. So to see, you know, some this doctor who can look at him and know all this stuff that he's going through, even though Frank would never admit it, and you know, most people would never even know, but he's got to be going through agony just every day. You know, my mother broke her ankle a few years ago, and since then has had horrible problems with that, just from arthritis to infection and the screws in her ankle and all this kind of stuff.
Wow.
It becomes a huge deal, you know, when you're that age. So when you're Frank and you've broken God knows how many bones throughout your body, and you've been shot and stabbed and everything else, not to mention, you know, how many concussions has Frank Castle had over the course of his life. All that shit's got to start to add up. So to throw all that in the mix when you've got Frank facing Bullseye and Kingpin, to me, that was very exciting.
It's a new kind of vulnerability for him that, yeah, I don't, again, with the occasional future story, I don't think has really been explored before.
Right, yep. Yep, and yeah, that will continue to be a big part of the book. I mean, I think we saw, you know, from the climax of that first arc, the Kingpin arc, took Frank a while to recover from that. Well, now he's about to face down Bullseye, and that's going to knock him down to an even lower state. So we'll see again if he's able to fall his way back up or not. And
that's terrific,
once
man.
Once he does, you know, he'll be back to square one. And that he'll be in a situation where Kingpin's able to take away his safe houses and his guns and his money and his arsenals and everything that he's built up. And so how does he come back and take down the biggest enemy he's ever faced when he doesn't have anything? You're starting from, you know, ground zero.
Very interesting, man. This is great. You know, again, a different kind of story, as you say, than what you've been telling in Scout. So, you know, I got to say, too, I always end up reading Scout more in trade than I do with the single issues. But I did catch up and wanted to bring myself up to date. And this most recent issue was fantastic. And again, another look at a different kind of Vietnam vet. And definitely informing the characters. I don't want to spoil. So I just think that the story is at a very interesting point, both in terms of the most recent trade and also the two-issue wrap-up that we just got on the Chief's number one man. And now taking a look at a piece of Dash's history that maybe hadn't been revealed before.
Yeah, the stories we've done so far in Scout this year are ones I've been waiting to write for a while, really. Like, 35 was a completely 100% standalone story, and that it was focused on two characters who we had never seen before and who we'll never see again. So it was really like a mini, you know, this is a 22-page graphic novel buried in the midst of this series.
Fantastic.
That was something I've been wanting to do for a while, and the story that focused on Shunka, on Red Crow's right-hand man, that was something that was originally going to be a part of an earlier arc, but I decided to wait. And because I waited, it really grew into something else entirely. I don't know if we should spoil kind of what it's about or not.
I want people to really read. That's the thing, man. I always go through this with you, much in the same way that I did with Azzarello when I'd have him on during 100 Bullets. It's like, I don't want to spoil, because if you're not reading Scalped, I think you're doing yourself a disservice not jumping in and really reading this story. The great thing is, I do think that as much as we were dropped in the middle of the story of your last trade, it still read really well. And that's a testament, I think, that you've been able to achieve in a way that I don't think Brian was able to achieve all the time in 100 Bullets as well. And as you say, with issue 35 and this most recent issue as well, 35 and 38, you've got a good sense of putting a lot in 22 pages. You're giving people their money's worth, I think, whether it's a continuing story or the standalones.
Well, thanks. Yeah, that's always what I've wanted to do, right? You know, you hear a lot of talk these days about people writing for the trade. Well, I don't know how to write for the trade in that sense. If I was Bendis ahead on things, where I was 6 months ahead, maybe my stories would read differently. But right now I'm writing, you know, an issue of Scout, and then I'll go write Punisher and Wolverine before I come back around to Scout. I haven't been in a situation where I can sit down and write 5 issues of Scout in a row. Maybe that's why my stuff, is a little more, or it might read a little better in single issues. I don't know. But I like that. I mean, I want each issue to feel like you are, in some sense, getting your money's worth, that it's not just, you know, one chapter of a longer story that doesn't really make much sense or have much impact on its own. And, you know, with Scout, from the get-go, I think, you know, all of us involved kind of realize that, you know, the strength of this book is going to be the cast of characters that we have. So if people don't like these characters, they're not going to like the book. And, you know, we talked a lot at the time about when we were doing what became the second trade, which was the Casino Boogie.
Casino Boogie, yes.
It was an arc that focused on 5 or 6 different characters, I forget.
Mm-hmm.
Each issue focused, you know, was from the perspective of a different character. And, you know, we wondered at the time, like, well, is this too early to do something like this? And that you're, you know, usually when you're focusing on doing these character-driven issues, that comes later in the series. But, you know, like I said, we figured that, well, if people don't like these characters, they're not going to stick with the book. So we did that, and those were some of, you know, readers' favorite issues at the time. So I stuck with that. I love doing those character-centric issues. And even beyond our main cast, I like exploring some of those characters, you know, from the shadows. Like Shunka was one I'd been waiting to write for a while. And the Vietnam War flashback issue, that focuses on a character that we had hardly seen at all.
Right.
Those first 37 issues, but who was very much around and certainly was a presence and a character that people ask about a lot. So I've been looking forward to addressing him. And even going forward, there are other characters we haven't really focused on much that we'll see. The sheriff from the small town in Nebraska, who we've glimpsed briefly, he's got a story coming up.
Cool.
Granny Poor Bear, who's Dino's grandmother that we've seen here and there, she's got stories. So there are other characters who haven't got their chance in the spotlight who will still get that. You know, not all of them relate in any big way to what the overall story for Scout is, but I think they're still very important because, again, I think hopefully the appeal of Scouts is really that tapestry and the setting that we've built up. And so all the stuff we do to kind of fill in the different corners of that, I think, are important to the series, even though they may not reflect, you know, impact directly what's going on with our main little group of characters.
This is very, I think people might have, especially from the first issue of Scalped, gone in expecting Donnie Brasco, but even what you've just said underlines for the people like me who have been reading it all along, knows it's more like The Sopranos, where, you know, when you for people who haven't read it, when you do focus on a Pauly Walnut story that really has nothing to do with whatever the season's main complication is, but it informs the character, and as you say, it expands on the tapestry, and we saw that and continue to see that a lot. And as you say, these detours with Shunka and, you know, again, even the Vietnam vet story that you just did in 37.
Right. So, and, you know, I if anything, I I'm always trying to copy The Wire however I can.
Sure.
I love The Wire. The Wire has had a big influence on Scalp from day one. And then I think I, you know, discovered The Wire around the same time I was first starting on Scalp. So that's had a big influence, and just the richness of the setting and the huge cast of characters and trying to juggle all that. I mean, not that I feel like I'm in any way doing something that deserves to be mentioned in the same breath with The Wire, but, you know, that's just what I strive to emulate.
Well,
you know, I love The Sopranos, too, and I've still never seen the entire series run. I didn't have HBO there for part of it, so I still haven't seen probably the last two seasons, but I love The Sopranos. I, you know, really like the TV show that kind of that Will Dennis, my editor, and I first started talking about when Scalp was kind of first, you know, being born, was Crime Story, was Michael Mann's Crime Story.
Absolutely.
Which Scalp kind of moved away from that, but initially it was going to be that same kind of setup, and there was just the, you know, the cop and then the kingpin on the rise that he's working to bring down. That was the initial sort of dynamic we were going for in Scalp, that, you know, it kind of grew from that. But
we'll stop there with part one of our talk with Jason Aaron. There's more to come in part two. That'll be coming up later in this week. Keep your eyes open at wordballoon.com for part two of our talk with Jason Aaron. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. It was brought to you by Edward David Gill's technological espionage book, The Expert on Everything, a novel that's been described as Catch-22 meets 3 Days of the Condor. A young man is offered a 6-figure job at Vector Systems and is mistakenly handed a prototype piece of technology that can effectively wipe out all privacy in our society. He's pursued by a governor with presidential ambitions, several U.S. senators, and begins to get death threats from the device itself, called Wallace, which seems to have developed artificial intelligence. BookReview.com gives The Expert on Everything 5 stars and calls it a smooth, interesting techno-thriller. You can purchase the book at Amazon.com or at Gill's website, TheExpertOnEverything.com. Check out the book. It's a great read. The Expert on Everything, a novel from Edward David Gill. John Sutcher's reminding you that the road to San Diego continues here at Ward Balloon. More great interviews on the way. More top creators coming in to tell us what their plans are for San Diego and some of the projects they have going on now and things in the months ahead. So keep listening here at wordballoon.com, at iFanboy. Subscribe to our feed at iTunes. If you have any questions or comments about the show, make sure you follow me on Twitter under the name John Wordballoon, or you can follow me at Facebook under my name, John Suntress. Email me at john@wordballoon.com, or leave a question at our message board at jinxworld.com, which you can access as well at wordballoon.com. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2010.